This podcast is sponsored by IQBar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQBar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Warning: the following contains spoilers pertaining to the show and subject matter discussed. Also, strong language and adult content may be included. Listener discretion is advised. Thank you.
Stand clear of the closing doors, please.
You think we're still good on time?
Absolutely. We're on the right car to just jump off, run up the stairs, and out the station. Trust me.
All right.
Best part about seeing a show at the St. James Theater, you can just walk right out of the 44th Street subway station and into the line for the show.
Okay, you were right. This did work out perfectly. Honestly, I can't believe we were able to get tickets to the show.
Hottest ticket in town right now. I'd call us lucky. I can't wait to see it.
It's all anybody has been able to talk about for the longest time.
Well, now we can be included with them. I'm most excited about seeing Gary again. He's truly one of my favorite people.
Well then, let's not dilly-dally and head inside. And welcome to Stage Whisper. I'm your host, Hope Bird, and with me is my co-host, Andrew Cortez.
Today we are going to be discussing the mega blockbuster, The Producers.
So hurry and take your seats. It looks like the show is starting.
Join us now as we keep it light, keep it bright, keep it gay, because today we are going to take you back to 2001 and to a landmark show that ushered in the new millennium and a new chapter in the tomes of the theater.
We are, of course, referring to the Mel Brooks mega hit musical, The Producers. It took Broadway by storm and left a lasting impression on the world that is still resonating to this day.
Stemming from the ingenious mind of Mel Brooks, The Producers, the musical, was based on the 1967 film of the same name. David Geffen was the one who persuaded Brooks to take the film from the screen to the stage. Mel Brooks, who wrote both the music and lyrics, would also partner on the book with Thomas Meehan. For the role of director and choreographer, the great Susan Stroman would be enlisted.
The rest of the design team would be assembled as followed: Sets by Robin Wagner. Lights by Peter Kagzaworski. Sound by Stephen C. Kennedy. Costumes by William Ivy Long. Hair by Paul Huntley. And makeup by Randy Houston Mercer.
With the design team assembled and the amazing and talented cast amassed, the show rehearsed, was polished, and finally arrived on Broadway on April 19th, 2001 at the St. James Theater.
To say that the show was a hit is an understatement. It was the first blockbuster of the new millennium and raised the bar on what a smash musical on Broadway was. The show broke box office records for largest single-day ticket sales in theater history, taking in more than $3 million.
The Producers was nominated for a record-breaking 15 Tony Awards. Only two other shows have come close to being nominated with so many. Billy Elliot tied with The Producers, receiving 15, and in 2016, Hamilton beat out The Producers for most nominations, earning 16 Tony nominations.
However, Hamilton would not walk away with more Tony wins than the Mel Brooks comedy. The Producer still retains the title of most Tony Award-winning musical in the history of Broadway theater, winning 12 Tony Awards, which include Best Musical, Best Score, Best Orchestrations, Best Choreography for Susan Stroman, Best Scenic Design by Robin Wagner, and Best Direction, Susan Stroman.
Also, Best Costume Design, William Ivy Long, Best Lighting Design, Peter Kagzaworski, Best Book of a Musical, Best Feature Actress in a Musical, Kathy Huffman, Best Feature Actor in a Musical, Gary Beach, and finally, Best Actor in a Leading Role in a Musical, Nathan Lane.
With all the notoriety and numerous awards, it's no wonder the show would see such huge success and extend its run on Broadway. The show would run for 6 years and 2,502 performances, closing on April 22nd, 2007.
Wow, that was a lot to cover, and we are only just getting started. Whew. But let's delve into the story itself.
In 1959, New York City theater producer Max Bialystock opens Funny Boy, which is a musical version of Hamlet. We hear the song opening night. The show is absolutely terrible, and the show closes after only one performance.
Max, who was once called the King of Broadway, tells a crowd of down-and-outs this while listing his past achievements and makes a vow to return to his former glory.
The next day, Max is visited by a mousy accountant named Leo Bloom, whom has come to audit his books. While he is there, one of Max's little old lady investors arrives.
Max tells Leo he must wait in the bathroom until she leaves. While Leo is in the bathroom, the little old lady plays a sex game with Max, who is persuading her to give him a check to be invested in his next play to be called Cash. That's a very odd name for a play. But of course, so was the Iceman Cometh.
After she leaves, Leo reveals that he has had a lifelong dream of wanting to be a Broadway producer. While revealing his secret, Max touches a blue blanket that the accountant keeps on him at all times, thus sending Leo into a panic attack.
After recovering from the attack, Leo tells Max that he has found an accounting error in the book. Max has raised $100,000 for Funny Boy, but the play only cost $98,000. This leads Max to beg Leo to cook the books to hide the discrepancy, and Leo reluctantly agrees.
Leo does some quick calculations and realizes that under the right circumstances, a producer could actually make more money with a flop than with a hit, such as if you raised $1 million and you put on your $100,000 flop, and then you keep the rest.
Max proposes a scheme. Step one, we find the worst play ever written. Step two, we hire the worst director in town. Step three, we raise $2 million. One for me, one for you. There's a lot of little old ladies out there. Step four, we hire the worst actors in New York and open on Broadway. And before you can say step five, we close on Broadway, take our $2 million, and go to Rio.
However, Leo refuses to help Max in his scheme. He heads back to work and is unfortunately 6 minutes late. His boss, Mr. Marks, cruelly reminds him that he is a nobody. While he commiserates with his coworkers slaving over accountants and accounting, Leo daydreams of becoming a Broadway producer in I Wanna Be a Producer. This leads him into realizing that his job is terrible, and he quits and goes back to Max's office.
The two spend the next day searching for the worst play ever written. While looking through their piles of scripts, Max finds what he calls a surefire flop that is guaranteed to offend people of all races, creeds, and religions. The show is called Springtime for Hitler, a gay romp with Adolf and Eva at Berchtesgaden, written by ex-Nazi Franz Liebken. He sums up the script to Leo by calling it a love letter to Hitler.
Well, so the two men go to the playwright's home in Greenwich Village to obtain the rights to the show. They find Franz in his tenant roof with his pigeons, reminiscing about the good old days. The producers convince him to sign their contract by singing Adolf Hitler's favorite tune with the former Nazi, Der Guten Tag Hop Klop. They also make a promise by reciting the Siegfried Oath under penalty of death to never dishonor the spirit and memory of Adolf Elisabeth Hitler.
Not many people know this, but the Führer was a fantastic dancer. With the show rights secured, Max takes Leo to the townhouse of the worst director in New York, a flamboyant and gay man named Roger Debris. Roger and his common law assistant, Carmen Gia, decline the original offer because the subject material is too serious. They insist that for a show to succeed, you must keep it gay.
Max tells Roger that this could be the show that could be the show that wins him a Tony. Roger sees the possibilities and agrees, but says the second act must be rewritten so that the Germans win World War II.
Max and Leo return to the office, where they meet a Swedish beauty who wants to audition for the next play. Her name is Ulla Inka Hansen Benson Janssen Tallin Holland Svaden Svensson. Yeah! She auditions for the men by singing When You Got It Flaunted. Obviously impressed by her talent, they hire her to be her secretary / receptionist.
Max then goes on a mission to raise $2 million for Springtime for Hitler by calling on all of the little old ladies of New York, which is successful and ends Act One.
Act Two starts with Leo and Ulla alone in Max's office after being redecorated by Ulla, all in white. The two start to fall in love. Max returns to the office and we see him falling in love with Ulla's backside.
The group then holds auditions for the title role of Hitler, which brings out the worst of the worst in actors, and all are rejected by Roger. Franz comes out and performs his own jazzy rendition of Happen Sie gehört das deutsche Span, and Max commends his performance by shouting, "That is our Hitler!"
When opening night finally arrives, the cast sings a song about it's bad luck to say good luck on opening night, which is concluded by Franz falling down the stairs and broke my leg. This leaves only one person who knows the part of Hitler, who can replace him, Roger Debris.
As the curtains rise, Max and Leo prepare to watch the theatrical disaster unfold before them. Springtime for Hitler. To their dismay, Roger's over-the-top campy performance leaves the audience in tears. With all the added humor, the audience mistakes the show for satire, and the show becomes a overnight success.
Back at the office, we see a near-suicidal Max and Leo singing Where Did We Go Right? Roger and Carmen enter to congratulate the men, only to find them fighting over the accounting books. Just as we think things couldn't possibly get worse, Franz bursts in, waving a pistol with murder in his eyes. He's outraged by Roger's portrayal of his beloved Führer. Max suggests that he shoot the actors. Yeah, the actors! And not himself, as a way to get the show closed.
The police overhear the commotion and arrest Franz, who breaks his other leg while trying to escape. They also arrest Max and take the books as evidence while Leo hides. Ula finds Leo and persuades him to take the $2 million and run away to Rio with her.
While Max is in jail awaiting trial, he receives a postcard from Leo explaining what happened after he was arrested. Max sings the song Betrayed, in which he recounts the whole show. At his trial, Max has been found incredibly guilty. Before the judge can give Max his sentence, the newlyweds, Leo and Ula, arrive to tell the judge that Max is a good man and has never actually hurt anyone, maybe just swindled them.
The judge is touched by this and decides it's best not to separate the partners. He decides to send Leo, Max, and Franz to Sing Sing prison for 5 years. Making the most of a bad situation, they write a new musical called Prisoners of Love, which makes it all the way to Broadway, starring Roger and Ula. The governor, loving the show so much, pardons the pair. Knowing that they have become kings of Broadway, Leo and Max walk off into the sunset.
The show ends with the whole cast coming back on stage for one last song, Goodbye, where they tell the audience that they need to leave now. And that's the show.
Yeah.
So we got to talk about, now we got to talk about, you know, what we like, what we hate. So, you know, what we like.
The show is just so simple, yet, like, there's a ton of layers to it.
Look, Mel Brooks can't do wrong.
No.
Mel Brooks is comedy. Mel Brooks has this down to a T, and everything complements everything. Everything is perfect. It's like when you bake that perfect cake and you have just the right amount of ingredients and everything complements itself. That is exactly what this show is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the right amount of offensive mixed with right amount of humor and love and everything. It is the complete love letter to Broadway. It can be offensive, but not offensive, if that makes sense. Like, no one's truly going to be that offended by the show, but at the same time, it's like, well, that might offend someone. Nah. You know, is it too soon to talk about it? Nah. It's all good. I mean, it's the perfect satire. It's exactly what Broadway needed. And we're going to get into it, but it's a perfect time for it. So, rather than rambling, let's break this down. I want to start with costumes.
Oh my gosh, the costumes.
So, they're beautiful, they're simple, they're gorgeous. This is not one of those shows like Follies or something where it's like the detail beaded work in there. No. This, you know what time period it is. We're going to be blatant. We're going to be obvious. Everyone's got these beautiful silhouettes. Roger's gowns are brilliant. One of my favorite is when they first meet Roger and he's getting ready for the choreographer's ball. And it's like, that gown is you. Really, I don't think so. I'm supposed to be the Grand Duchess Anastasia, but I feel more like the Chrysler Building. And it looks like the Chrysler mm-hmm. Building. And I'm like, that's that tongue-in-cheek. We know what you're supposed to be, but we also know what you're supposed to be.
And I think it works so well because, like, I mean, there is a ton of beautifully gorgeous beaded gowns and stuff because that's what the time period was trying to recreate.
Oh, yeah, Ula's gowns and stuff,
but they don't stand out because they're not the focus of the show, yet they make the perfect, like, complement to it. It's like having a breeze of cool air on a warm summer's day as you watch the sunset. It just all hits perfectly.
I would love to see the dry cleaner who got these costumes, by the way. You know, pick them up after like a dress rehearsal. And it's like, oh, cute. Look at these beautiful gowns. Oh, look at these suits. And then it's like, these are full-on Nazi suits. These are stormtrooper suits. I mean,
thank goodness
the details
they have
weren't
their,
missed,
but
you know?
Thank goodness they have their own dry cleaning.
Every detail was covered. And then even in like the subtler details, when we meet all the designers, all of the gay designers, it's like a modern Theater Village people. And one of my favorite moments is when the choreographer comes on. And look, if you're a big theater buff, if you're not, here's a fun fact. So we have in the theater what's called dance belts. They're special undergarments that are meant particularly for men. I think only for men.
There are, yeah.
That are meant to hide certain parts.
Well, they're
of
meant
the men.
To smooth it out.
Yeah, so that you don't have protruding nether regions. And when the choreographer comes down, he has a clear bulge. And that is the point. It's poking fun at that. Now, look, everyone's laughing at the joke that he has a bulge, but if you're in the theater, you're going, ha 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 ha, there's a joke and a joke and a joke. There are layers to this. Well, and they're incorporating that in the design element, you know? Mm-hmm. You knew that was thought of during the process of how can we make this moment even funnier?
Well, and what I really appreciate about this show, which we can definitely talk more about later, is that there's a reason why the original movie, the musical, and the movie of the musical are all the exact same thing. It's because it was so nice. They did it twice.
Yeah,
they did
it
thrice. You know what I mean?
And also, kudos to the people who had to make these costumes, because if you've ever gotten to see the show in a full production, little old Ladyland, it's the same dress and hat and gloves and knee highs and everything. It's the same outfit. Every little old lady apparently dresses the same way. I'm going to look the same as everybody else after 65. Like, I'm excited. It's brilliant. Which leads me to the next thing, which is the set. Now, these are... Okay, this goes from... This stems from clever to just, like... Again, the simplicity makes it awesome. They had these sets, you know, when we opened, we're at the theater, you knew exactly where you were and had that like art deco, I don't want to say comic book feel, but you know, very retro old world feel, because of course, you know, 1959, mm-hmm. But we knew where we were at, and when the scenes would change, you didn't have these big, I'm going to call them Lincoln Center sets, because every time I've seen a show at Lincoln Center, they just flex how big their stage and that is. They didn't have to do that. There's like, we're going to put like a few walls and a few people and you.
And they were flats.
And your brain finished the rest of this and you saw the fully realized place. And it was brilliant. You know, when Bloom goes back to his accounting firm, you know, you have a few accountants there and they have some dim lighting, but you could just see how depressing it was. It was just brilliant, you know. Then you had like the Springtime for Hitler set. And you see that joke and that campiness. And the thing I love the best is they bring in these mirrors at first. And you're like, okay, this is... I mean, I'm just going to say it has like this S&M kind of bondage feel to it, which it's already kind of had with the whips and the girls and in the sausage costumes, which we should have mentioned, the different foods that Germany's known for. And it's kind of sexy and ooh, there's sexual tension there. But you've got these stormtroopers... And, you know, clearly this, like, sexually repressed Aryan race guy. And these mirrors come in. You're like, all right. And then they kind of lift up. And as they're singing Springtime for Hitler, these guys form a swastika. And thanks to the mirrors, you see the swastika rotating on stage. And you're like, okay, that's clever. Because, you know, it's one of those, we want you to see this detail. And I thought that was great. One of my favorite... And I love it. I mean, I hate it because it's at the end of the show. But what I love is when they show at the end that they've made it. Spoiler alert. Well, you've already heard this at the beginning. The spoiler alert. At the end when they've made it, they're showing all the shows that, you know, Bialystok and Bloom have done. They spoof, essentially, a bunch of famous shows, but they make them all Jewish. Mm-hmm. And they're putting up all, and so there's all these marquees in this like scrim, I'll say, or mm-hmm. different places that they light up at different times. So you've got like cats, but it's K-A-T-Z, you know, or things like that, you know, and it's hilarious. And I'm like, that's clever. You know, I'd like to see if they remounted it now, like what other shows would they put up there? It's those little details that you're just like, ah.
Mm-hmm.
Easter eggs is what I would say.
Yes, that is definitely a good definition of Easter eggs. Yeah, good
look
job,
at
Andrew.
Me. I can do that. So speaking of lighting things up, let's talk about the lighting.
Oh my gosh, the lighting. Ugh. Well, for one, it's just very, like, clean lighting, which I know sounds really strange, but it just makes everything nice and bright. It was clear as to what time of day we were in, whether it was daytime or nighttime, whether we were inside or outside.
And it sounds like a minor detail, but it's not just about lighting the actor so you can see them. It's giving you
a sense of mood, sense of time.
As we're progressing and we're moving through, that really, if they're filling in those little bit of blanks that help your brain continue the story on.
Well, and I personally think that the more clean the lighting looks, the more it reads as comedy.
Exactly, yes.
Because
I
if you start
agree.
Getting too many gobos and too many shadows, it starts to read more dramatic. But the fact that you can get nice, clean, crisp lighting,
yes,
it just sends you into comedy land, like, right away.
Also, when you have, like, the opposites playing. So, for instance, I love Little Old Ladyland. When we're going to Little Old Ladyland, we know what we're doing here, okay? This is a whole song, and it's cute, and it's fun. Guys, he's sleeping with a bunch of little old ladies to raise money. It's these roses and pink tones, and Bialystok just looks lovable and so happy and always want to pinch his cheeks and fire down below. You know, it's cute and it's fun. And you bounce out with their blue costumes. It just looks great. And I'm like, this is clever. Because this is a horrible, 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 despicable thing he's doing. And the lighting choice they've made it, it's almost like a children's TV show, you know?
Yes.
But then you counter that with, I think it's almost borderline comic book where he's in jail and we've got this gray, it's got kind of like that incandescent light feeling. He's got that swinging light bulb, which I love because I'm like, okay, yeah, because we're going to have light bulbs in a jail cell. All right. But that's cool.
I mean, listen, it was 1959.
I guess. But then, and then back to your gobo point though, now they've got these jail bars. Which I think helps to establish because he's got one. I think he's in a cage, but it helps in that big stage make it feel. It really makes it feel much smaller, and you feel that trap feeling. And I'm like, we didn't have to bring in 40 different set pieces or clothes. You know, make it super black and dark and everything. They use these different lighting effects to make you have a feeling to feel what the actor felt. And speaking of light bulb and jail cell. Can we talk about walkers and props?
Oh my gosh. And, like, I just love this idea of... Okay, well, so first off, to talk about, like, walkers with the tennis balls on it. I just want to know, like, did they do research to find out when people started putting tennis balls on the bottom of their walkers?
I gotta be honest, I don't remember if tennis balls are on the bottom of the walkers, but it's been that long since I saw them.
I thought they were.
But I hope they
are. I know for sure they are in the movie, which...
Listen, if you want to see, if you've never seen the show, and you want to see, like... one of the greatest, like, moments in theater history, Google the producers at the Tony Awards. They did Along Came Bialy, the Little Old Ladyland song at the Tony Awards, and they do the whole dance with the walkers. And I'm just looking... I watch this, and I'm like, Susan Stroman, you are a genius. Because anyone that can incorporate walkers the way that they did... Look, it's a bit. We see a woman with a walker, and it's like, okay, we're not just going to watch her walk across and say, oh, no. This is going to be a full-fledged production number, and it's going to be centered around this walker. And it works. And I'm just like, I could watch this all day. It's brilliant. It's ridiculously brilliant. Mm-hmm. The other thing I think a lot of people walk away from the show, absolutely adoring, and everybody, I don't care who you are, you're going to love it. The pigeons. Okay? The pigeons. Especially little Adolf with his wing flop, you know, that flops up. These animatronic pigeons that sing and everything with Franz Liebken. I mean...
Are they animatronic or are they puppets?
Oh, no. They're animatronic, I feel like. I feel I don't think there's someone behind it with their hand up it going...
No, but it could be like on...
sticks and...
Oh, yeah, no. Well, that's what I mean. I mean, it's not someone hand puppet. It's...
Oh, no. Yeah.
But, you know, as far as I know, I mean, look, someone listening to this could have worked on the show and been like, you're wrong. And for that, I'm sorry, I never worked on the show. But it's so, again, it's simple and it's clever. It's not so low budget that we're like watching, you know, I don't know. I don't want to trash community theater by any stretch of the imagination. We're not watching a construction paper theater kind of thing. But we're also, you know, not having to get that, like, hologramic kind of thing. It's just something simple, and I'm like, that's perfect.
Mm-hmm. Also, I just really, I love how clever the music and the book go together. I just, like...
So, you know, like we said, Mel Brooks wrote music and lyrics and helped with the book, and mm-hmm. it goes so well,
like together. there are jokes written into the music, and that's one of the things that I just absolutely love.
And he brings in other jokes from other things. Like one of my favorite things in The King of Broadway, you've got this thing in the second verse where he goes, "I used to be the king," and everyone goes, the king of old Broadway, and the guy playing the fiddle. Yeah, it's good to be the king. Yeah, and I was like, that's not from this show. That's from another Mel Brooks show, and I'm like, that's funny.
Well,
that's
that's
a callback.
Right? Well, and also even like just the music, no words at all. They're just different little points that are just, there are jokes in them. I'm trying to figure out the best way to describe it.
For Springtime for Hitler, when Roger's performing, it's like Judy Garland at the palace. Like it is hardcore. Where he gets out there and, you know, he makes his entrance and then he just gets up there and he throws his hand back and everyone starts to laugh. It's that Judy Garland-esque, like, I've arrived, and he gets up there, hi-oh, myself. And he's, you know, having a field day. He even makes the Ethel Merman joke, you know. There's all these great Broadway just nods in all the music,
mm-hmm.
you know. We're having a field day at that, and I want to be a producer. It's almost like a Ziegfeld Follies number.
Oh, yeah. That's exactly what it is.
With the dancing and the song. Oh, it's brilliant. So the music only enhances it. And we're going to take you to school just real quick for a minute, okay? Because we got degrees in theater.
Right.
In musical theater, okay, in a successful musical, the only reason why people sing is because the emotion of the moment or what they're feeling is so great that words alone... Cannot express it. We have to sing. And this is exactly it. There's something going on that words aren't going to be enough. We got to sing it. And that's exactly what happened.
Well, like, and what's really nice is some of them are just these mundane things, you know, but they still turn, there's so much emotion behind it. There's such these impactful moments that we have to turn them into singing.
The audition alone is absolutely hilarious. Everyone gets these like 5-second bits and I'm like, I want to hear more of these songs. I want to hear more of the little wooden boy, you know? Mm-hmm. And it cracks me up. And the other thing that makes this work leads us into the next one. The direction. Guys, when you see a Susan Stroman show, you know it's a Susan Stroman show. She is one of those directors that exists that when you see her work, you know exactly it's a Susan Stroman show. Bullets Over Broadway, for instance. You know it. And... this show, she gave a masterclass in direction with it. You know, there was never too much of anything. There was never too little of anything. She pushed the bar just enough to make everything work.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you watch that show, and I want to find room to critique and go, well, you could have done
but
this.
But there's
and
I'm no, like, there's just, I want to say the word synergy, but I feel no, like that's wrong. But it's like every single element comes together in the most perfect way. At all times.
Everything and, leads to each other.
Well, and that's one thing that, for me, makes a successful show is something that I get sucked into the world completely and I'm not able to pick apart the different elements.
Absolutely.
Like, as we've been even trying to break down the little elements, we keep going back and forth to other pieces because they all just meld so well together.
And you've got these big personalities and these great actors in the show. You know, Nathan Lane, Matthew Broderick, Brad Oscar, Caddy Huffman.
Uh-huh, and Gary Beach.
Gary Beach. You know, fantastic, fantastic cast. One person doesn't overshadow the other. Mm-hmm. Everyone's character is on the same plane. Everyone's, it's not competing for the limelight more than the other, where everyone is working together, striving for the same goal. It works. And the other thing I love is the awkward moments and the tensions. They always arrive right on the right time, mm-hmm. and the jokes land together as well. A lot of the jokes, it's like that awkward fart in church, but it's that welcome fart in church, you know? Uh-huh. I love the Elizabeth, Adolf Elizabeth Hitler. Yeah, that was his name, you know? And mm-hmm. it's like...
Okay.
How do you relate to that?
And you really get to just like enter the world and everyone just, it's almost like an improv when everything is yes and. Yes. Everything is yes anded in it, even if it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
And it's great.
And while we're talking about Susan Sherman, finally, I want to talk about the choreography. We've mentioned it before, but anyone that can incorporate walkers into a big dance number, I mean, is something special. Like, where do you go from there, right? I mean, hang up your hat, you're done. That's it. That's the apex. But the dancing in the show, it's amazing because what I love is this show, how do I put it? It's not a dance-heavy show, but it is a dance-heavy show. And what I mean is the dance is heavy with the ensemble. And they do it so well. And they accent and add in so well where they need it. They act as a true chorus. Mm-hmm. And it literally is like that cherry on top, sprinkles on everything. It adds that glitter to the show. That extra little oomph that makes it feel like a golden era musical.
Right, but is it... Well, and what I really love about it is it's almost like anytime you've listened to... A song that gets sweetened. It's like we're listening to the song today. I think it was Luke Bryan that was singing, and it's a song about him liking this girl, but there's a girl singing in the background with him because it just adds to that fully rounded sound.
Yeah,
and that's how the ensemble goes. Because sometimes, yeah, it's about them, but also other times they're just enhancing what we're seeing on stage.
And then keeping in line with the whole love letter to Broadway. You've got moments in the choreography that are complementing different shows. You know, when we're doing I Want to Be a Producer, we've got this great 42nd Street moment where they're coming down the stairs with the lights. When they're doing King of Broadway, we've got this great Fiddler on the Roof moment. You know, there's great Chicago moments with some Fosse-esque movements in there. It's truly brilliant. They set out a goal and a vision, and they went for it, and it worked.
Mm-hmm.
A few more fun facts about the show. Obviously, we can't skip over mentioning the notable cast members again. The show has seen including the amazing Nathan Lane, as well as Matthew Broderick, Gary Beach, Katty Huffman, Brad Oscar, Angie Schwerer, and Roger Bart.
Also worth noting, after the original cast left, it was detrimental to the production's success, which prompted Lane and Broderick to return for a limited engagement, which broke their own record for highest ticket sales in one single day, going to $3.5 million.
Two other actors of note to mention, Jason Alexander and Martin Short, headlined the leading roles while the tour was in the city of L.A.
Finally, on the TV show Curb Your Enthusiasm, the producers was featured in almost every single episode of season 4. In the episode, Mel Brooks offers Larry David the part of Max and Ben Stiller the part of Leo. When David and Stiller have a falling out, Stiller is replaced by David Schwimmer, and David keeps forgetting his lines and ad-libs to keep the audience laughing. It is revealed that Brooks cast David believing that he would fail and end the show, to free Brooks from its success. And then Brooks's real-life wife and Bancroft laugh at how bad David is, but to their dismay, David ends up being a huge hit.
So let's now talk about the impact the show has had on the theater and its history. First off, it's the first big blockbuster of the 21st century.
Yes.
It's the first mega hit of the 21st century. It had the most Tony Award nominations at that point. Since then, Hamilton surpassed it. But it still has the most Tony Awards won by any show, play, or musical, sitting at 12. Just those three right there. Check, check, check. I mean, it's been 20 years, and it's still... I mean, it's the producers.
Oh,
it's
my
the
gosh, show. It has, I feel like, been 20 years.
It's been 20. I know the lockdown and everything. Oh, it feels like it's been 15, but it's been 20 years.
And it still hasn't been topped.
That's the show that every other show now is raised against. And, you know, I know I would like to think our listeners are excited one day when we do our Hamilton show.
Right.
But I'm the guy over here and you're the girl over there. And we've seen... Oh, Lord, between us, over at least 200 Broadway shows. At least.
At least.
And, you know, Hamilton didn't beat the producers. And I'm the guy that's like, I want to see the show.
That tops the producers.
That's going to be a show. But those three right there are just, I mean, that's three mountains to climb for some show.
Right.
And I think it raised the bar on musicals in general and on musical comedy. I mean, I don't want to say that musical comedy, you know, before wasn't, let's say, smart, but I mean, I think that after the producers, like, the wit and the jokes and the humor, it was a whole nother level, you know. It wasn't just enough to come on and tell a joke or to throw a pie or, you know, how do I put it? To me, there's like kind of like two kinds of comedy. There's that slapstick comedy, vaudeville-esque. There's kind of the comedy that almost offends you. You know, we're going to see a
yes,
bad language.
Yes, like, I feel like Mel Brooks is that perfect combination between. Yes, well, because you have like on one side, you have like the Neil Simon type, you know,
plays, but then
on the other side, you have Dave Chappelle.
Yes,
you know what
yes,
I mean?
Yes,
and
yes.
Mel Brooks goes right in between.
Exactly. And so now going forward after the producers, it was like, okay, it's not enough just to be one or the other. You have to be able to master both. And musical comedies going forward, that's what they're going to be measured against, you know. And not only can you make me laugh, but I feel like audiences left going, I understood that joke.
Yes. Well, I feel like audiences felt like they were smart. They were given kind of, you know, they were still allowed to use their imaginations to help fill in the gap. And so it really just kind of bred this, like, every man also kind of giving them that complex of being smart and superior. It, you know, because I feel like most of the time with musical comedies, you either get the highbrow or the lowbrow.
Yes.
And this totally gave both. It gave the lowbrow, you know, this idea of being highbrow, and it gave the highbrow enough to be like, oh, you're laughing at a sex joke.
You're feeding me exactly to my next point, which is it opened the door to subject matter that we really didn't talk about in the theater.
Yes.
And what I like is it, speaking of highbrow, lowbrow, it's showing that screw your brows.
Yeah.
We're all going to laugh at the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
We all kind of genuinely as humanity think, this is terrible, and we all genuinely as humanity think this is funny. Now look, on a micro level, that might be different. There are certain minor things that we think are different, but as a whole, there are certain things we see or experience that we're like, ha 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 ha, you know?
Well, it's like there's universal goods and universal evils.
Yeah.
And this kind of, you know...
And all of a sudden we're laughing at, you know, where we were raised, World War II, Nazis and all that is bad. Now we're laughing at them, and I'm like, yeah... That whole joke of too soon, it's like, okay, 40, 50 years has passed.
Well, and I think that it really drives the point home that, like, I feel like, you know, I obviously we've never talked to Mel Brooks about this, but I feel like you heal through humor.
Yeah, everyone heals differently.
Yeah. And so
at some point we have to laugh at it.
Because it takes away the seriousness of it all.
Absolutely. If you want to beat someone, take away their power, you can laugh at them.
Yeah, it's like with Harry Potter, you know, to scare the
Dementor?
The Bogart. No, oh, the Bogart. You know, you have to make it ridiculous.
Right,
you know,
right.
It's kind of that. I feel like that's what this subject matter is. It's like, you know, oh yeah, there's sexism. There's, you know, there's Nazis, and you know what?
Taking we're just advantage gonna, of the elderly.
We're just gonna make fun of it all. And
but the other
get
thing is, it points it at the end. It says, you know, these are all terrible and horrible things, but does anybody get hurt in the end? And you kind of go, I forgive all these horrible traits from people because at the end of the day, nobody really got hurt. You know? So,
yeah.
So this leads us to our next point, the societal impact. And the first one I want to talk about, it's interesting that you spoke both times about the amount of money the show made. $3 million and $3.5 million, respectively.
On one single day.
Yeah.
Each.
The show was making ridiculous amounts of money. Now, for all of you out there, if I get this information wrong, please send me an email at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com. Please feel free, because I believe this is right. But back then, back in my day, I believe at that time, you know, internet sales were limited of ticket sales. So at that time, you went to the box office. You could call Telecharge or Ticketmaster. Or you can go to three different locations, Chelsea Pier, Times Square, or One World Trade Center, which is where TKTS was, to purchase tickets. What the producers were battling were people were going and buying blocks of tickets at $60, $75, and then turning around and selling them for $350, $400. You know, scalpers. And they weren't having it. They were like, no, that's not going to be a thing. So knowing that they had a surefire hit that anyone's going to pay any amount of money, give up their firstborn, they decided, and this is, as I recall, a first in Broadway history, they're like, no, we're going to raise our prices to fight scalpers. And suddenly people were paying $400, $500 for a ticket to see the producers buying from the show, not from a scalper. And the producers figured, to hell with it, if you're going to spend that kind of money, might as well come to the people who actually created and are doing the show. Mm-hmm. Not to these people that are peddling.
Right. Well, because here's the thing. Like, Broadway shows are expensive. They're expensive to put on. They're expensive to run. You know, and so might as well, you know, try to make as much money as you can while still trying to stop people from basically profiting off of your hard work.
Yeah, but most Broadway shows, the reason why they're expensive, I mean, you see a lot of people who put on the show, but there's a lot of people behind the scenes and whatnot that you don't get to see that have to be paid too. And remember, everyone that works in the theater is also union. God bless the union. Everyone deserves a livable wage. And not to be political, but if you haven't noticed, the cost of living's gone up, but the minimum wage hasn't. So thanks to the union, they've made sure that people who work in the theater have maintained a livable wage. So that, ergo, the price of tickets have gone up. But the thing is, with the producers doing this, suddenly other shows
started doing it
to counteract scalpers.
Mm-hmm.
And it started a whole new thing where it was like, oh, hang on a second. This is okay to do. So if you had a hit, why not?
Right. Well, and it really just started changing the whole concept of going out to a Broadway show.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you're spending so much money on it. Like, yeah, you used to make like a big deal of it, but now it's like a big to do. Like,
it wasn't something you did in like a layover, like, oh, I'm gonna just go catch a Broadway show.
No, it's like people nowadays will stand all day in their sweaty clothes, whatever, in the heat, waiting just to get entered into the lottery, just to possibly win tickets. And then you have barely enough time to go from your sweaty line spot to get to the theater. So, like, you're not even getting all dressed up necessarily, mm-hmm. because you're so excited to just finally be able to get the show because of how hard it was to get the ticket.
I remember seeing Chicago shortly after the Book of Mormon opened and going to pick up our tickets that morning, and there was already a line that morning for the Book of Mormon lottery, mm-hmm. right? In the morning. Lottery's not till that evening. Fast forward, you know, about 5-6 years, I remember seeing Dear Evan Hansen on Broadway, and we leave the theater, and there's already a line that night for the next day's lottery.
Mm-hmm.
This is what kind of came about from the producers, where it was like, we're going to start this whole new, it just ushered in a new idea of what, like you said, what the theater was and how we kind of treated this experience, not just a show, but an experience.
Yeah, it's not like, you know, oh yeah, I'm going to go get some tickets. It's like, oh my gosh, like I had to work to get these tickets. I'm going to savor the experience. This is something that is special.
Which is also why, on a tangent, I get pissed off when people get on their cell phones or they're talking, because I'm like, you know, you may not be interested in this, but for someone, this could be the one and only show that they could get enough money together for, and this is a life-changing experience. I think that the Broadway Theater is just such a great, great, like, everyone should get one in their life to get to see, because it will change you forever. Mm-hmm. But then with, you know, with the time of the show opening and the advent of technology, it led to other things like, obviously, online ticket sales, which is probably what we all do now. And still to this day, there are further advances in ticket sales. And it started with this battle for battle of the scalpers from the producers. For instance, Ticketmaster does what I call legal scalping, where you can resell your tickets. However, part of what you resell it for still goes to the show. So if I buy Hamilton tickets at $90 and I decide to sell them for $400, so that's an upsell of $310, 50% of what I'm actually selling it for still goes to the show. So it's a way that these shows have, these different merchants have started to counteract scalpers. In the UK, and I love this, when you buy your tickets for certain shows like Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, for instance, again, this is what I've been told, so if I'm wrong, emails, but you buy your tickets with a card, your ticket is on the card, and when you arrive at the theater,
you
swipe your credit card, and then they print your ticket there, and that's it. You can't go out and sell your ticket.
It's kind of the same way you would do for sporting events, too.
Exactly, yeah, and it's a way so that you can't resell your ticket. Once you buy it, you buy it. So people can't come in and buy blocks of tickets and then go out and resell them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's absolutely brilliant, because, you know, no one should be making money off of a show they had nothing to do with. And you shouldn't keep people out from seeing the theater. That's my TED Talk. Anyway, back to the... And it started with the producers. Someone finally sent it up to scalpers and finding them.
So...
It was... we want to take you back. Remember, this was a show that opened in the spring of 2001.
So...
And we all know 2001 was a landmark year, not just because the producers was a history-making show, but of course shortly after the terrible tragedy of 9/11 happened.
Yeah. And, I mean, crushing is the only word that I can think of to describe it.
Yeah.
You know, it changed so much about everyday life. It changed so much about the landscape.
It was the first time. And as we record this podcast on what we hope to, God willing, be post-COVID, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was the first time Broadway was empty.
Yeah.
You know, you look back at images after 9/11 when Broadway was closed, when it was dark, and it was empty. And, of course, pre-COVID, your heart sank, and you're like, oh, God, I hope we never have to see that. And you think about Broadway's been closed for over a year.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just getting teary-eyed thinking about it.
Well, because if you think about it, like, through history, really the only time the lights ever go completely out on Broadway is when they're doing a tribute to someone.
Yeah. Or during World War II when there were the...
Yeah.
But exactly. And the streets were never empty, and they were just so barren at this point. And there's a great clip of Rudy Giuliani, who was the mayor, and it was a few days after 9/11, and he was encouraging people. He was like, come to New York. Come visit New York. Come see a show. You might have a good chance of getting tickets to the producers now.
Right. Well, and there's... I can also think of the commercial...
About the I Love New York, where they had all the cast in Times Square?
Uh-huh, from all the different shows. And, of course, it's the iconic Nathan Lane's voice.
Come to New York, and let's get on with the show. I think it was 3 or 4 days later, and again, another source, Broadway the American Musical, and when the cast was asked, you know, or when they were going back and they thought, are we okay to laugh again? And there's a great moment when SNL came back. I think it was the week after 9/11. Rudy Giuliani was on the show with some firefighters and that. And, you know, they were doing the opening. And Lorne Michaels was, you know, saying something. And he said, well, can we be funny? Mm-hmm. And Rudy Giuliani says, why start now?
Right. And, well, and it goes back to that humor through healing through humor.
Exactly.
And so it was a nice escape.
Yeah.
That was already set up and already familiar. Like, that's, I think, one of the most beautiful things about the timing of the producers was it was something that we knew before and it was something that was the same after.
It was exactly what the doctor ordered to allow us to laugh, to heal. And it wasn't and something it was consistent. That we could laugh at, like, a current event. It was something of the before time.
Mm-hmm.
But what I... As a theater person, as an actor, what I truly cherish is in the moment of great darkness and despair, you know, everyone was asking, when is the right time to laugh? When is the right time? When can we move on? You know, the theater answered the call a few days later, and we didn't, like, come out and was like, okay, is everyone okay? Are we feeling safe? Are we came out, we did our job, and our job was to make everyone laugh and be happy, entertain, and feel.
And forget your troubles for just a little bit.
And, man, sometimes September can't that. Come here fast enough when Broadway returns and the world just needs to laugh and heal and feel better. This is another show that brought multiple generations to the same show. And you mentioned it because you had the original film version with... Mm-hmm. I can't remember his name. He played Willy Wonka. What's his name?
I can't.
Gene Wilder.
Oh, Gene Wilder. Oh, Gene Wilder. Gosh.
And Zero Mostro. And then you had this musical. And then, of course, later on, you had the movie musical. It brought multiple generations to the theater.
Well, and it just was something that felt familiar to many different generations.
It's humor that everyone got.
Because, like, I feel like the producers for my day and age, and I guess my day and age is still happening and it's right now. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like this is one of those stories that just, it feels so classic. You know?
It's a timeless story.
Yeah.
It really is. And it let us laugh at things that we weren't sure we were allowed to laugh at.
Mm-hmm. It reminded us that, you know, it's okay to poke fun at yourself. It's okay to laugh at evil.
That's exactly it. Mel Brooks literally said was telling us the best way to defuse evil is to laugh at it. It's to stand up to the evil things in the world and laugh at its face. And that's how you take its power. And I thought that, especially with the timing of the show when it existed on Broadway, that was just such an important message. So finally, is the show still relevant? I mean, we don't have to spend 40 minutes on this. I think the answer is...
Yes,
yeah.
It will always be relevant. It is always a show that can be done in any setting.
I feel like the St. James Theater is current... I mean, Springsteen on Broadway is playing there, and I think American Utopia is going there in the fall. But hey, wealthy producers out there, I feel like a spring revival of the producers at the St. James is not a terrible idea.
Not at all.
I think we all need that after the 20 months we've had of this chaos. It's going to be relevant. It's going to continue to be relevant. We need to continue that message of the best way to overcome terrible things, terrible people, terrible situations purely is to laugh. Everything and everyone, there's bad nature in there, but there's also good.
Mm-hmm.
But all are connected through humor.
Right. Life's not black and white. There's many different shades of gray, so we might as well laugh while we're here.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Finally, as promised, we wanted to share some of our own personal stories about experiencing these shows, or this show.
Yeah. So I've seen the show twice. I saw it once in 2008 here in Salt Lake City at Pioneer Theater. And then I've had the great fortune of seeing the show on Broadway in 2006.
I haven't yet actually had the chance to see the show live on stage, but I am very much looking forward to it soon. So please, someone, revive it.
So then I guess I have the stories. The first one I want to say, I had a best friend in high school named Alex Watson. and we were doing our drama club's Tony Awards, my junior year, his sophomore year, and we were doing The Number We Can Do It. I was playing Bloom. He was playing Max. This is a side detail. I promise it's going to come back. That year, we were doing a fundraiser of these candy bars, trying to raise money, fund the drama department, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, we're doing the scene. It's really good. It's really funny. And when I'm having my freak out over my blanket, he threw water, and it was real water. I wasn't expecting that, but I was like, cool. And he really slapped me. It's going over great. Well, as we get to the audio cue doesn't go. The sound person forgets hit play on our song. So we immediately, both being improv actors, just start improvising in the middle of the scene and start to sell candy bars. And we totally start to sell candy bars to our audience members. Finally, the music comes on. We do our number. Everything works out great. But it was so much fun. It was so much fun. Still one of my favorite performances from high school. I think one of my favorite stories that comes from the show. Oh, I'm going to get all teary-eyed thinking about it. I got to meet Gary Beach, one of my heroes again. When I was in New York in 2006 on my high school trip again, the producers was playing and we saw that Gary Beach was in the show. So, we got tickets to it. My mom and I saw the show. He was in it. We sent a note backstage hoping to see him the night we saw the show. Unfortunately, he left prior to, us getting down for the stage door, which was a bummer. The next night we were seeing the 25th annual Putnam County Spelling Bee. And we did a talk back. And the timing of the shows worked out perfect because we did our talk back. And then we ran the 6 blocks from the Circle and Square Theater to the St. James.
I'm just laughing thinking.
You're just
about
thinking about
mom
running. Terrible human being.
I'm sorry, Lori. Okay. I'm sorry.
I ran. My mom briskly shuffled. love you, Mom. Anyway, we got to the St. James Theater just as the show was finishing. Now, any of you who've ever been to the St. James Theater and stage door, you know there are 2 stage door exits. There's one kind of by the main hall that takes you to the lobby, and there's another on the east side, kind of near the Jew Jamison Theater offices. So, we're both 2 different doors, okay? Fun fact for all of you playing at home, the east door is the actual stage door. It's the door that leads actually to the stage. The one over by the lobby leads to the lobby and then all the way around the stage. But anyway, my mom's over on the east one. I'm by the main one, doing our thing. Gary Beach comes out the east door, sees my mom. He'd gotten the note from the night before that day, sees her. All these people rush him. He just ignores them. See, and says hi to my mom. How are you? Small chat. And she goes, I'm great. Can you give me 1 second? My son's over on the other side. Let me go get him. Again, there's all these people clamoring for his attention. And he goes, no. Let's go over and walk over to him. He walks over to me. Tony Award winning Gary Beach. Walks straight up to me. I am starstruck. Again, more people are trying to get his autograph. And he just gestures for me to come over to the side and the other side of the barrier, and we just start talking. And he just, for about 45 minutes, we just chat, we catch up. He was the sweetest, kindest guy in the world. He then asked, you know, what I was up to, and I told him about high school, senior year, blah, blah, blah. And he goes, oh, will you be coming back to New York anytime soon? And I said, well, I did. I auditioned for choir because they were going to New York City the next year and I got in. That's the only reason why I did choir. And he goes, oh, you're coming back to New York next year. Great. Well, I'm doing Les Mis next year. You should definitely come and see the show if you can. And I was like, I'm buying tickets to Les Mis, apparently. And he got a picture with me and he just said, I look forward to seeing you in the spring. Thank you so much for seeing me. It's so good to stay connected with you. And I was just touched by him, you know.
He remembered you after all this time.
Yeah. What kind of an act? I mean, oh, that man was absolutely amazing. This show opened my eyes to musical comedy, and it just inspired and solidified my love for the theater and what I wanted to do. I remember seeing the show in New York, and just when I saw The King of Broadway, I went, I kind of like this. I kind of want to do this. And then when I saw We Can Do It live, I was like, yeah, this is what I'm going to do forever. That was my, like, you know, some people were like, I was 12 and I saw the show. And I was like, no, I was 17. I was in the back of the St. James Theater. I saw We Can Do It after doing it at my school's Drama Club Awards. And I went, this is what I want to do, you know. And the other thing is, and for all my big people out there, this show let me see roles that I could play. And I think it's, you know, there's a lot of talk in the theater about representation, which I don't want to take anything away from the conversation about representation, particularly about race and that. But I do want to say, when it comes to body size and body type, there is a conversation to be had. Because I do remember going to school, and I do remember being the one guy that was big, and it was hard. It was really, really hard finding roles that you know, besides being, I mean, I'm fine being funny, but, you know, whenever I met someone, they're like, oh, so what, you like play Shrek, or you play Nicely Nicely? And I'm like, there's more than that, you know? And in this show, I went, oh, I could be a Max, I could be a Franz, I could be a, you know, a Roger Debris. Like, it made me realize that there's more out there for a guy like me, and that meant the world to me. So this show meant a lot. As things begin to return to normal and the theater world starts to turn its lights back on, we look forward to returning to see the show again.
I sincerely hope that you'll be able to catch the producers at a theater near you this fall.
We just want to mention as well that as things are opening up, we encourage all of you to support the arts, whether it be local, regional, or of course, Broadway.
Now more than ever, it's time for us to raise up and foster the performing arts wherever they may exist.
Please join us in doing your part to help the arts return by supporting a live performance near you.
We ourselves have already begun this work and will have a special announcement regarding this very soon.
So until next time, I'm Andrew Cortez.
And I'm Hope Bird.
Reminding you to turn off your cell phones.
Unwrap your candies.
And keep talking about the theater.
In a stage whisper.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, please leave us a 5-star review, like, and subscribe.
You can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Stage Whisper Pod.
And feel free to reach out to us with your comments and personal stories at stagewhisperpod@gmail.com.
Our theme song is Fox by Music for Wildlife. Other music on this episode provided by U.S. Army Blues, The Good Louds, Milton Arias, Mella, and Billy Murray.